So what we're going to do today is really explore this Schrieffer-Wolf perturbation theory that we just briefly introduced yesterday. Most of this introduction will not be the gory details of a perturbation expansion that you might remember when you first were introduced to perturbation theory. That will just be a small part at the very end where I'll sort of give you the details on how to calculate term by term all of the things in the expansion. Yeah?
Do you know which, if this corresponds to a chapter in this, in Neil-Sinn and Fock?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. So if you want a good reference, this is by far the best, okay. I would say. Despite, it's a new paper, it's a very old technique. Decades old, and there's been lots written about it. It's used quite widely. But this one really, I think, puts it on a firm, rigorous footing, and also sets it in a bit of a more modern language. So what we're going to do today is, it's like I said, we're just going to do that the actual expansion right at the end. That's sort of the least interesting part. The most interesting part is setting up the framework for how we can think of perturbation theory in terms of a relationship between these effective low-energy theories, one of a simple model, one of a complicated model. And there's going to be a bunch of techniques we're going to need to introduce in order to think about the mapping between these two things, which are very much based on the techniques we've seen so far in this course. It's really just a lot of linear algebra. So hopefully this lecture, despite being focused on perturbation theory, will not seem too perturbation theory-ish in that we're going to focus on an analytical framework for the whole problem and a bunch of linear algebra techniques we're going to use to solve it. And only at the end will we really do a Taylor expansion that sort of starts producing the terms you need in an application of this. Here's just the slides that I covered yesterday. And let's remind ourselves what the essential idea is we want in this. So I've set up the framework for the type of problems that we could think of applying Schrieffer-Wolf perturbation theory to. But it turns out to be quite a generic technique where we have some complicated Hamiltonian with a subspace of states, possibly degenerate, possibly non-degenerate, but nonetheless separated in energy from the rest of the Hilbert space. We want to think of mapping that in some way to an equivalent subspace in a simpler model, and finding a way of systematically expressing out, in terms of a Taylor series, in terms of powers of epsilon, the terms in how that complicated Hamiltonian acts on this space in terms of how it will act on this simpler space order by order in the perturbation theory. So a lot of what we're going to try to do today is really developing properties of maps from subspaces to subspaces that are in some way the least disturbing to the properties of that subspace. We want that unitary that takes you from here to here to have some specific properties, and then to construct a framework that's going to be amenable to doing a Taylor expansion of something that's going to let us think about that mapping at different orders in perturbation theory. I had some questions yesterday about sort of the details of the advantages of this scheme compared to others. I've used it on a number of occasions, and it's the second point that really makes me happy. It's a very straightforward technique to apply. I often suggest to high-year undergraduate research students or first-year postgrad students that they should learn this technique and use it for a specific problem that we're working on. And the reason I suggest this one is because then I know it's rigorous. it's on a firm footing. We know properties about its convergence and so on that mean I don't have to worry about whether we're applying it in the wrong regime. It's quite clear about when it's going to work and how well it's going to work in those regimes. In comparison to other standard techniques like the Feynman-Dyson diagram technique, that's really based on some adiabatic assumptions. And if you're going to base things on adiabatic assumptions, that usually involves a assumption about non-degenerate ground states. So this works well when you have degenerate ground states like are now very common in a whole range of interesting quantum many-body systems like topological models. It doesn't mean that those other techniques won't work when you have a degeneracy. It just means you have to be extra careful. And you know what I like about this is you don't have to be careful. You just have to be systematic in your application of a proven technique. And then the final one is also really what's making it quite practically useful for problems in condensed matter physics, in quantum many-body physics, in quantum information, a range of other fields. If your goal is to find not only an effective Hamiltonian coming from some complicated Hamiltonian, which might be local, it might involves terms in that Hamiltonian which only cause an interaction between spins with it that have some spatially local support. There's a systematic way to make sure that all of your terms, that all orders in your perturbation also are going to be local in that sense. We're not going to describe that. In fact, we're not really going to talk about any of these details here. But these are all just advantages of this particular flavor of perturbation theory, which I think explain why it's currently quite fashionable to use. It's rigorous, it's practically useful, and it satisfies this. It can satisfy this locality property if you so desire. The trick is that it's a bit more conceptually challenging than a traditional approach to perturbation theory, and that's why we're going to spend most of the time today going through the conceptual framework and sort of an analytical discussion of what's going on here to understand how this thing works, and then you know the actual details of the perturbation expansion I'll just give to you and because it's not really worth seeing all the details. So what are we going to start with? As I said, we're interested in, at some point, coming up with maps between subspaces and other subspaces that are, in some sense, we're going to define the least disturbing. We want the map that takes P to a very similar type of subspace, P naught, of a simpler model. And we don't want to completely mix around the different eigenstates and so on. We'd like them to move to the sort of the closest eigenstate. And so how do we do that? What sort of techniques do we have to even describe maps from a subspace to another subspace? So here we're going to do some linear algebra. So let's start with an assumption of working with finite dimensional spaces. This is, again, if you're working in a condensed matter setting or a quantum information setting, this is quite standard that you pick some number of n spins. You're then finite dimensional for any n. You're interested in properties in the thermodynamic limit, but we treat those questions of taking the thermodynamic limit as a separate issue. So let's consider finite dimensional Hilbert space H. And for any psi in this Hilbert space, consider the following operator, the identity minus twice psi. And think about it, how it acts on a space. Well, it's pretty obvious from inspection that it will take psi to minus psi, But any state that's orthogonal to psi, it will leave invariant.
Is it a minus 2 psi? Is that a minus?
That's a minus, yeah, minus 2 psi. Does that not look like minus?
Yeah, sorry.
Flip sine of psi acts trivially on the orthogonal complement. Okay, we're going to use this to construct for a pair of states what we want is a unitary which will map psi to phi. Up to an overall phase. Of course, there's many such unitaries. We're talking about an action on a specific state, and the unitary will act on the whole space. What we're ultimately looking for, again, we're trying to devise some techniques for mappings between subspaces which are minimal, direct, shortest path in some sense, which we're going to define. And so we want to pick out one that's going to take psi sort of the most directly to phi, and we want it to leave everything else alone. Okay, so here's a choice, and we're going to then prove some properties. We're going to call it the double reflection. R phi, R psi. Oh, okay, and so this is not such a unitary. I'm introducing this operator. So it acts on the span of these two vectors, a two-dimensional subspace of the total Hilbert space. It rotates this space by an angle 2 theta, whoops, where theta is going to be the angle in Hilbert space between those states. Sorry, I erased a bit of that. By 2 theta, where the magnitude of the overlap I can write as an angle. And this acts as the identity elsewhere. And let's define now this operator as the square root. And we'll show that this square root is well defined. What I'm going to do, I've just defined this operator. I'm going to show that square root is well defined, and then we're going to show that it has the right properties of mapping psi to phi. Okay, so what do I mean by the square root there? So that's acting on operators in this Hilbert space. I have to define how it acts to the square root on complex numbers. So let's just take the normal thing where I define it to act in the normal way on the positive real axis and put a branch cut at the negative real axis. And then it will act on operators in their eigen decomposition through the square root of their eigenvalues. OK, so that's just a sort of normal definition of what I mean by the square root of operators. I can only have that be well defined if that operator that's the double reflection doesn't have any eigenvalues minus 1 lying on that branch cut, right? Okay, so here's a little lemma that I'm going to use. If we have that phi and psi are non-orthogonal, then r phi r psi has no eigenvalues on the real negative axis of the complex plane. And that means if I take two states that are non-orthogonal, then that square root's going to be well-defined, and that's going to be a good unitary operator. Let's prove this lemma, because the construction is, I think, going to give you a helpful little picture of thinking about what the resulting operator is. So let me go on to the next slide to prove this lemma. Okay. So since this operator, and in fact this operator, acts trivially on the complement, the orthogonal complement of span of these two vectors, I'm really just interested in how it acts on a two-dimensional subspace. Let me now think of those vectors as qubit vectors in that two-dimensional subspace. Of course, they can actually be they're vectors in the larger space, but they're components in, I've said that poorly. All the interesting properties are just given by the two-dimensional subspace spanned by those two vectors. I might as well just choose a basis for that two-dimensional subspace that looks like a qubit and express those two states as qubit states in that subspace of the full Hilbert space. So we're going to restrict to the qubit case C2. So without loss of generality, let's pick psi to be the vector 1 and phi to be sine theta 0 plus cos theta 1. So choosing to work in this real two-dimensional subspace in particular. Okay, and then I'm going to restrict that angle to be between 0 and strictly less than 2 pi, because I want those states to be non-orthogonal. The goal is to prove that if it's non-orthogonal, that we can take the square root of this double rotation operator. So what do the rotation, sorry, what do the r sub psi and r sub phi operators look like in this basis? This operator looks like the Pauli Z, which flips psi and acts trivially on the complement. R phi looks like cos of 2 theta z minus sine of 2 theta x. That's just a Pauli operator in a different direction. Yep.
Why do we choose that specific form for phi? Why is there no e to the power I phi?
Oh, so we're just going to pick our two-dimensional subspace. Let's define a qubit basis. So I can basically define the state 1 to be psi, and then I can define the state 0 such that phi takes that form. Okay, so it's more like a choice of the basis for that space I'm working with. Okay, so then what does this double rotation operator look like? It looks like, just using properties of Pauli matrices, which I can recognize right away is just a rotation about the y-axis by angle 2 phi. And since we have 2 phi now, since phi is greater than or equal to 0 but strictly less than pi on 2, then 2 phi will be strictly less than pi. And then that operator clearly has no eigenvalue on the real negative axis. And the negative real axis. And that gives us what is this square root operator? It's e to the I theta y. And we note, if I rotate psi, which is the one state, with that operator, I will get I, the other operator. So that's really quite the general form for this rotation of states. You can always just put it into this qubit basis, and then it's a rotation about the y-axis. Makes it quite clear. You can really why we're really thinking of these things as rotation operators, why we call them direct rotations. Okay, so let's go now back. We've just proven that lemma. Let's go back to our definition. Okay, so that's now a well-defined rotation operator. It acts in a whole space. It's acting trivially on everything that's outside the span of those two states. And within those two states, it's just rotating by the angle that's defined by the overlap of those two states. And it's rotating the one state into the other. I should say, you know, it's rotating. Just to be clear, it's rotating psi into phi. It's not rotating phi into psi, right? Okay, so let's fix this to be real and positive. In which case, then we have it go directly to that state. We don't get an overall phase. Okay, so here's a corollary, which is going to be the start of what's going to be useful in our perturbation theory. I mean, here we're doing a rotation of states. We're going to extend this to subspaces. But what we're going to want for perturbation theory is not just to think about that rotation that takes one subspace to another or one state to another, but we want to think of how it is generated by an operator. And it's going to be that generating operator, which is what we're going to do perturbation theory on. Okay, let me define two projectors. The projector onto the state psi, the projector onto the state phi. This is going to start to put things in the form that we're going to generalize. These are going to generalize to projectors onto subspaces. Okay, so we're going to write U in terms of a generator. Now, I haven't put the I in there. It's just e to the s, not e to the is. So that means s will be anti-Hermitian. And then here's some properties of s, and we're going to prove them. First property is that, so s is anti-Hermitian. We sort of think of it in terms of off-diagonal elements having opposite sign. And what we're going to find is that in this basis defined by either of those projectors, we can think of this as being off diagonal. So PSP is going to be equal to P naught S P naught. It's also going to be equal to, sorry, not plus, equal to I minus P S I minus P, all of these things are going to be equal to 0. For this particular unitary that takes this state to this state, I'm going to be able to think of it as generated by this anti-Hermitian operator, which is really going to have a nice sort of off block diagonal, block off diagonal or off block diagonal, block off diagonal form in terms of both P in its complement and in P naught in its complement. That's going to be one of the nice characteristics of this particular S that's going to generalize nicely. We're going to prove that. And then also, the norm of S is going to be less than pi on 2. That we need only a small norm generating operator to give us that unitary. And this is going to help us sort of define a sense in which this is sort of the least disturbing, the shortest path unitary that's going to take that subspace to that one. It's going to least minimally mix up those eigenstates. Okay, so I'm going to do the proof of this down at the bottom of the next lemma here on this page, using this all the same framework here. Proof of corollary. Okay, so here it's obvious what S is. S is equal to I theta y. And okay, so I have to think, here I said I'm restricting to a two-dimensional subspace. If I wanted to say, how does that operator act on the bigger space, then I just have to pad it out with zeros, right? It acts as zero on the complement to that two-dimensional subspace. S acts as zero because e to the s wants to act as the identity, right? So if we think of extending it, and then here we have a basis, so we can just check these properties. So let's check what is ys. psi s psi. That's checking the condition PSP, right? how'd that happen? That's just I theta. Psi is the state 1. So that's just the expectation value of 1 in the state 1 for the y Pauli. That's off diagonal, so that's going to be equal to 0. You can also check that this is true for phi. It's a bit more of a calculation, but there we can show, these cross terms are all what matters. So we have 1, y, 0. That's non-zero, but we have to add to that 0, y, 1. And that also cancels because of the properties of y. Got an I and a minus I on the off diagonals. So that means P equals 0 and P naught S. P naught is equal to 0. You can check the conditions for the complement, but that also is also true. I'll leave that to you guys. It's trivial. Check that this equals 0 and this equals 0. So what have we done here? We've defined a nice simple unitary that's going to rotate one state to the other. We've shown that it's well defined if those states are non-orthogonal. It is generated by this anti-Hermitian operator, which has a nice form. For one, it's bounded. It can't have magnitude greater than pi on 2, largest eigenvalue greater than pi on 2. So it's that's going to be our notion of saying this is like the shortest path. It's also got a nice structure to it in this sort of block diagonal form. We're going to make very extensive use of that, especially when we extend things. So any questions on that? So we've done it just for two states. Now I want to show that this framework generalizes for two subspaces. There's going to be sort of an equivalent number. There's an equivalent lemma and corollary for the subspaces, which I'm not going to give the proofs for because it basically follows quite straightforwardly from these state proofs. So it'll be more believable when you see it for the subspaces because you've already seen the proofs for the states. But you can fill in the details if you want. So let's extend this to a pair of subspaces. How can we rotate one subspace to another in this same framework? Okay, so let's now take P and P naught. They are both subspaces of H. Let's pick them to be the same dimension. We're going to come back to that idea of these guys needing to have the same dimension. Let's define projectors P and P naught onto those two spaces. So I will try to write my subspace P's nice and scripty so that it is clear that they're different from the projector P's. But we're going to be more interested in the projectors. You know, the projectors are sufficient really to define a subspace, so we'll be not using that script notation very much. So now the idea of non-orthogonality of two states that we needed to define this particular rotation operator is going to be replaced with a different condition. Here's the condition. We want the norm of this difference to be less than 1. So what does that mean? Let's think about it. I'm taking the difference of those two projectors. Now, when could it be 1? It can never be greater than 1 because the projectors have eigenvalues 1 or 0. But when could it be 1? Well, if there was a state in P that is orthogonal to all the states in P naught, then that norm would be 1. So this is really saying there's no state in P that's orthogonal to all the states in P naught, and there's no state in P naught that's orthogonal to all the states in P. They have the same dimension, so that's possible. That's how you should interpret that condition. So this, and that's can be made as a formal statement if you want. This holds if and only if no vector in P is orthogonal to the whole space P naught, and vice versa. That's going to be our generalization of this condition that the two states which we wanted to rotate into each other had to be non-orthogonal. Now we want these two subspaces. We can even say, do we have a term for that condition? Well, when those subspaces satisfy that relation, then we're going to be able to define this rotation. OK, so let's do some generalizations of just what we've seen before. It goes along nicely. So let's define a rotation operator for the subspace P, which is just identity minus 2P. So this does just like that rotation operator did in the first case. That was for a state. It flipped the sign of that state and left everything else that's orthogonal to it invariant. Here we're going to flip the sign of everything in that subspace, everything that's in the support of that projector, and leave everything else alone. And then we're going to try to define our U operator, which is going to try to take P to P naught. In the same way, we're going to take it as the square root, and we have to check that it exists, of the rotation operator for P naught and this rotation operator for P, the product of the two. We're going to call this thing the direct rotation.
It's again from P to P naught?
Yeah, from P to P naught. Yeah, I could put subscripts on there, but it starts to burn the notation. And so here, remember what we're trying to do. We're trying to go from this complicated model to the simple one. The complicated model has a subspace P. The simple model has a subspace P naught. Remember, the naught in perturbation theory always means the simple, unperturbed model. We're trying to go from the complicated to the simple. And that's always the direction that we're going, from P to P naught. Okay, so we call this the direct rotation. So here's the analogous lemma and corollary from what we had before that we're not going to prove because the proof sort of follows very much like the proof for the states. And given that it's proven for the states, you'll probably believe it. Okay, so lemma, we take this thing that's replacing the non-orthogonality condition, no eigenvalue, there's no eigenvalue of the double rotation operator on the negative real axis. And therefore, root R P naught R P is uniquely defined. Loosely, because we're banning the existence of any state in one space that's orthogonal to everything else, we never have to do a full rotation of a state to an orthogonal state. So that would be a rotation with eigenvalue minus 1. That's the thing we never have to do because you don't have any two states being orthogonal. Every state just has to go to something that is rotated by an angle of less than pi on 2. Yeah?
So even if it's not uniquely defined, can I just pick one? Like, what's the problem that arises from it's not uniquely defined?
It is uniquely defined.
For the case that there are orthogonal.
So you're asking about what would I do if I wanted to extend this to the case where it's orthogonal. I guess the point is there you have more options. Yeah, so it's not unique. Then you want to say, I want some additional criterion what to do in that case. So it depends on your application. But that's not going to come up here, so we're not too concerned. But yeah, you have that additional degree of freedom when you have some orthogonal states as to how I choose that direct rotation. So here's another thing I'm just going to note without proof, that this U then is the minimal rotation. And in what precise sense do I mean by that? It differs the least from the identity in terms of all rotations that could map P to P naught. Differs the least from the identity. What precisely do I need by that? I mean the norm of the difference between this rotation and the identity operator is this as small as possible for any unitary. There's some subtleties there. You've got to use a Frobenius norm in this case, unless the unless that condition is well bounded away from one. But nonetheless, I mean, you can, for a sensible notion of distance given by an operator type norm, you want to be as close as possible to the identity with this rotation, and this is the one that does it. Yeah?
That's the one that does it for all sensible norms.
For all sensible norms.
Like, yeah, because you say you don't have to specify norm. You can do it with Frobenius, but like, I guess the most natural thing to do would be just to take the normal operator norm. Like,
yeah. Yeah, so like I said, there's here's where you get into some, there's some details in the paper if you want it, not much. Some tricks in proving that this is the minimal rotation by the operator norm if that condition is very close to one. If you're well bounded away from one, then you can show that this is minimal in the sense of the operator norm, but it could be that they just haven't found a proof that applies all the way up to but not equal to one. If you use the Frobenius norm, you can construct such a proof that this is minimal. Yeah. So you've hit the limit of my knowledge about exactly what goes wrong when you're getting very close to that condition being one, and why you need to use a Frobenius norm. So I'll refer you to that paper if you want some more details. Okay, and then here's our corollary. So U can be written as generated by some anti-Hermitian S, yeah?
In our example, is it going to be the Hilbert space of the two systems the same? Or are we going to generalize this PLP node to the different Hilbert space?
Oh, yeah, good point. I said they both exist in the same Hilbert space. There's nothing that says they can't be in, well, by construction, I mean, we really, the thing is we define these rotation operators R on the same space, and then we wanted the unitary mapping one to the other. If you really change the, if you really made those spaces different, then you would have to have, you would have to impose, I think, some other mapping from one space to the other in order to be able to get from the definition of those rotation operators, which are defined only on one space or the other, to a unitary, which is intent on mapping you from one space to the other. You would need to make use of some sort of, I think probably all you need is an embedding of the H space into what you might call the H naught space. If you had an embedding, then a linear map, linear embedding, then I think you're all right. Good question, though. Okay. So the corollary is that this unitary can be generated by an anti-Hermitian operator. Of course, that's always true. But we can pick S to have some very nice properties, exactly like what we had before. It's has a lot of, it's basically block off diagonal, both with respect to P and with respect to P naught, the projectors. And again, the maximum eigenvalue of this operator is less than pi, strictly less than pi on 2, which is connected to this idea of minimal rotation. I mean, putting aside discussions of Frobenius and operator norm, the way I think about it, loosely, is you are characterizing how large or small of a rotation you have by what's the maximum eigenvalue of that, how much, you know, what's the state that gets rotated the most. And this one bounds it the most. It has the smallest, largest rotation.
And, will we be able to express this U in terms of the one that in terms of some type of composition or of the one that we considered before, or that's not a possibility?
Oh, in terms of so the one before with just the states had the nice expression in terms of a Pauli Y.
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean. You know, it's a rotation. There's, you know, this S is in some sense defining a direction in Hilbert space of which you're rotating everything around. But you don't have a block sphere anymore, so it's not as simple as thinking about it as.
Okay, so the last example was to prepare us for this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so as I said, I'm not going to prove these two lemmas, but they follow very similarly to the case before, and the details are in that paper if you were so interested. So our goal, just wait, so let's think back, we're trying to do perturbation theory again, we're trying to find a map from some we're going to think so of some subspace of a complicated model to a subspace of a simpler model. Now, this is going to be the map that we're going to use. We want to now construct that map explicitly in terms of properties of the Hamiltonian and so on. We're going to do that not by trying to directly construct U, but by constructing this operator S, which is going to be a very off-block diagonal, block off-diagonal. Block off diagonal, I think it's the right one. Block off diagonal anti-Hermitian matrix, and with bounded eigenvalues. So we want to know, we would like to put these properties of S in a nice practical form that's going to allow us to then figure out what S is for a given problem. Okay, so I'm going to do another lemma, which is basically going to be how do we find, it's not even how do we find S, so that's a question. The answer to that is going to be the Schrieffer-Wolf perturbation expansion. But, you know, more relevant to what we're doing here are what are some nice conditions that S must satisfy that we're then going to be able to try to satisfy those conditions for a given couple of Hamiltonians. So nice here means, you know, they're going to be practically useful conditions defining S. So here's a little lemma. Suppose we're in this case where we've got two projectors satisfying this. Then there exists a unique anti-Hermitian S. S such that three conditions. First of all, S generates a U, e to the S generates a U which takes P to P naught, and I can write that in terms of action on these projectors as follows. S is block off diagonal with respect to P naught, the simpler one. So that is P naught S P naught is equal to 0 and I minus P naught S I minus P naught is equal to 0. And S is bounded by pi on 2. Then U is equal to EXB of S is the direct rotation from P to P naught. Okay, so what's different here than what we just said before? Well, our corollary before posited an S, let's just flip back to it. I'll come back to the slide. It's satisfying these conditions. There was, okay, so here we have the two, it's Bloch off diagonal with respect to P naught. P naught's the simpler problem. It's also Bloch off diagonal with respect to P. And that's a harder condition to check because we maybe don't know, we don't want to express things in terms of the P states, we want to express things in terms of the P naught states. So the main goal of this next lemma is just to show that really that Bloch off diagonal with respect to P is a superfluous initial additional condition on S. It's enough to just make it that it is the direct rotation operator that takes P to P naught. It's Bloch off diagonal with respect to P naught only. And that it's bounded as follows. That makes it a bit simpler to actually compute things with. So we can work entirely with thinking about what S looks like, its structure, in terms of the simple Hamiltonian, in terms of P naught and being off Bloch off diagonal in terms of that. Okay, so to prove this lemma, we've already shown that there exists such an intermission S from the previous corollary. So the trick here is just to show that dropping that one condition still makes it unique. Let me just note that, and I'm not gonna outline that because it's not actually all that interesting, but the. The details, again, I refer you to the paper if you're very interested. So we know S exists. So just need to prove uniqueness. That those additional Bloch off diagonal with respect to P instead of P naught is somehow a superfluous condition on S. It comes from just these properties. Okay. Any questions on that? So again, a reminder, now we have, what are we trying to do? Well, we want to go from a harder problem to a simpler one. We want to map these subspaces. The goal now will be a technique for constructing an S that does it from a complicated model to a simple one, and to have a perturbative expansion for S where we can say some definite things about convergence and so on. Okay, so we're gonna very shortly turn to properties of actually applying this to the problem at hand. But let me just introduce one more aspect of these direct rotations, and that's really how they compose when I think of a Hilbert space now constructed out of tensor products of other Hilbert spaces. How does this direct rotation behave under tensor product? And we'll show something called weak multiplicativity of the direct rotation. So consider a bipartite system. Two Hilbert spaces. We have now pairs of projectors, PA, P naught A, and PB, P naught B. And let's put our condition on both of them. So there exists some direct unitary rotation that takes PA to P naught A. There's a direct unitary rotation that takes PB to P naught B. Now, okay, we have it for one space. For another, what if we wanted to think of the direct rotation on the tensor product? We can also think about a global, global direct rotation U acting on AB, which takes PA tensor PB to P naught A tensor P naught B. Well, let's note, and I'll give you an example or an argument, that this is not going to just be this. So let's think about how this would go in our simplest case where PA, P naught A, PB, and P naught B are just vectors. That was like our very first example. We're just doing a vector, a rotation of a vector from PA to P naught A, and a rotation of a vector from PB to P naught B. Then UA acts only non-trivially on a two-dimensional subspace of A, and UB acts non-trivially only on a two-dimensional subspace of B. That means this tensor product unitary acts non-trivially in general on a four-dimensional subspace of the tensor product. Whereas this one, which takes this projector to this projector, well, if this is, you know, a rank one projector, a projector onto a state, and so is this one, then their tensor product is also a rank one. It's also just a projector onto a state. So UAB is just taking that state to that state. It's acting non-trivially on a two-dimensional subspace of the tensor product, whereas this thing is acting non-trivially in general on a four-dimensional subspace. So they won't be equal in general. It doesn't compose. But there is a way in which we can think of getting something out of about UAB from the tensor product, and we're going to call this weak multiplicativity. Here's a proposition. If PA minus P naught A, so that's one, and PB minus P naught B, that's less than one, then PA tensor PB minus P naught A tensor P naught B is also going to be less than one. I'm going to state that with a proof. You can check that. And then what we have following from that result is weak multiplicativity. Which says that although these operators UAB and UA tensor UB are in general different, the way they act on the subspace PA tensor PB is the same. This, in my example before, in general active non-trivial on a larger space, four-dimensional. But if I restrict its action to the two-dimensional space on which this one acts non-trivially, it acts exactly in the right way on that two-dimensional subspace. Yeah?
So here, the equality is equality of sets, or what?
Equality of sets. Yeah, so what I'm arguing is that, this is an equality of operators on the tensor product. Loosely what we think of is, just think of the support of this, which defines a subspace of the tensor product, and the restriction of the unitaries to that support is identical. So I could project on both sides, multiply both sides by that projector as well. There I really have a unitary projected onto a subspace, and those things thought of as matrices are identical. Right. So let's keep going. So then now we have basically a whole bunch of properties of rotation. So now let's turn to the problem at hand. Let's use this framework to look at the perturbation problem that we set up to do. Though I should note that this framework of coming up with such direct rotations actually has many other applications. It's a useful one to learn. I've seen it used it turns out to be quite a nice tool in developing quantum algorithms. Quantum computers is trying to figure out how to map some quantum states to other quantum states. And often you want to know what's the sort of the shortest path to get there. I want to find a unitary that's going to take this input state to this output state, or this input space, the space of inputs to the output space, using the least amount of distance in operator space. And so the direct rotation can be used for that. Grover's search algorithm is based around properties of those direct rotation operators. So these techniques are quite widely used. But now let's focus on the problem at hand. So the first thing I want to do is let's pick out some sensible notions of subspaces that describe that, that are attempting to describe our low energy theories. I want to map subspaces of some complicated model describing its low temperature physics, low energy physics, to the subspace of a simpler model. I would like the condition that, generalized non-orthogonality condition to hold. So let's start thinking about some physical problems that will naturally lead us to having subspaces where I can think of a mapping because that condition does hold, that it's really a mapping of like non-orthogonal subspaces. So this involves being a bit clearer on this concept of the spectral gap that we just briefly mentioned yesterday. Pick a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And now, for the first time, we're thinking of some Hamiltonian operator. On this space. And of course, when you write the knot, that's the simple model. We call this thing the unperturbed Hamiltonian. Let's define a subspace by trying to pick out, here's the notion that we want to do. We want to pick out a subspace spanned by a range of eigenvectors of H where their eigenvalues fall in some interval. All the eigenstates with energy between this much and this much. Could be, in general, this is, the lowest band, but it could be anywhere in our spectrum, provided we have gaps above and below as we're going to define. Okay, so that's what we're trying to do. Now let me be a bit more precise. So we want a subspace spanned by eigenvectors corresponding to all eigenvalues in some interval. Let's call that interval I naught. So we're going to make no conditions on whether there's degeneracies or if they're non-degenerate or what. It's one of the nice things about this construction. You just need to take all the energy eigenstates with eigenvalues in some interval, regardless of degeneracies. Okay, we say that this model has a spectral gap delta, if and only if, for any pair, okay, and the spectral gap is related to a choice of interval, okay? If for any pair of eigenvalues, lambda, which is in the interval, and eta, which is not in the interval, we have that they are at least delta apart. Okay. So all the eigenvalues within the interval can be quite close to each other, and no assumptions about the relationship between eigenvalues outside of the interval, but there's no eigenvalue in the interval and another one out of the interval that are closer than delta. That says there's a big break in the spectrum between all the things that are in our interval and all those that are outside it, either above or below. The generic case is you're just excluding what's above, and you're in a low energy space, which includes the ground state. But there's nothing in the framework that restricts it that way.
But for example, aren't we still allowing that I pick delta, 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 and I pick all of this first delta space? And yes, whenever which every other that I take will satisfy that condition, but it's still my.
Yeah. Okay, so that's it's a good point. So there's no condition here on the size of the interval being small compared to what delta is.
Okay.
Like, they can be really spread apart. I mean, the range of things in I naught in our subspace could be enormous compared to delta, as long as it's quite clearly separated by delta from everything else that we're not going to consider. So, yeah, you're right. We have this notion of a bunch of closely spaced levels and then a big gap to other closely spaced levels, but that's, you know, that scenario does happen. That's a lot of scenarios of interest, but we're not restricted to that.
Okay.
Good point. Okay.
So you could you choose like your first two bands then, to like a band and then a gap and then a band, choose that to be here?
Yeah. It's quite flexible. Now, you know, what we want to do, I'll tell you where we're going. You know, we're going to want to make delta large because that's going to limit the amount of perturbation we can apply. Because what we want to do is have under that perturbation at subspace change and the eigenvalues will move around, but not enough to take them outside of the band we're considering and into something outside of I naught. Let me make that precise. Okay, so let's consider H is H naught plus some perturbation. So here V is an arbitrary Hermitian operator on H. Okay, so let's restrict E such that the magnitude of E has to be less than or equal to some critical value of E, defined to be equal to the spectral gap over twice the norm of V. E times the norm of V is saying, when I add this term to the Hamiltonian, E times the norm of V is the most that an eigenvalue of H can change. So restricting E in this way is saying, oh, I can never have an eigenvalue of H naught change by more than half the spectral gap. It can sort of get at most halfway out of my interval. So if I define a new interval, here I'll be sort of loose. Tell me if this is clear. A new interval, which is like I naught, and then we're going to add delta on 2 at the top and subtract delta on 2 at the bottom. That's going to define our subspace P of eigenvectors of now the perturbed Hamiltonian H with eigenvalue in I. Then for E less than EC, I still has a positive gap with the rest of the spectrum. We made it sort of half that value because something in I naught right near the top could have its eigenvalue changed by E magnitude of V and go up. One right at the bottom of the other band could have its eigenvalue changed by E magnitude of V. And they can get arbitrarily close, but there's still a positive separation there, provided this condition is satisfied. Yeah?
So do we assume we know the eigenvectors of H, full H?
Of H? No. So we don't know anything about them. But here we can make a statement on the range of which their eigenvalues can sit. If we've taken H naught with this interval, this gap, and then the rest, and we add on epsilon V for epsilon less than this critical value, we know that we don't know anything now about the eigenstates or eigenvalues, but we know that the eigenvalues can change by at most a certain amount and go into the gap. We know those outside can change at most a certain amount and go into the gap. And we've picked the bound on E such that that gap can never close. So we don't know anything about the spectrum of H other than it's still going to define a well-defined subspace P that has a positive gap, spectral gap, with the rest of the spectrum. And then it's quite clear that P and P naught, these are subspaces, have the same dimension. We've added on a perturbation. We don't know what happens to the eigenstates or eigenvalues, but we can definitely constrain what could happen. The eigenvalues within the interval can mix around, move around, and expand out a bit, but are clearly separated from everything else. And therefore, you know, it's not like a new eigenstate can suddenly appear in that interval. So this is good. This condition on the spectral gap, which is very relaxed, didn't say anything about degeneracies, provides first of all, two subspaces of equal dimension. And I'm not. I'm not going to do it today, but we'll talk a bit about satisfying that that non-orthogonality, generalized non-orthogonality condition. So let me just define two new things. We already have P and P naught as projectors onto P and P naught. Let me define Q is equal to I minus P, and Q naught is equal to I minus P naught. These are just the projectors onto the complement. We're going to use them a fair bit as well. Yep.
For the case in which this delta is very big, can we still do perturbation theory? Because, I mean, what we usually do is like expanding powers of epsilon, asking this epsilon to be small.
Yeah. So that's exactly what we want. We want delta to be big, and we want to be epsilon to be small compared to what delta is relative to the operator norm of V. Okay, so that's an energy, delta on V is just sort of an energy scale of the gap compared with an energy scale of this operator V. And we're just restricting the range of epsilon now to be fixed by that gap.
But I mean, for the case in which V is fixed and the gap is very big, I mean, I cannot do perturbation theory.
Yeah, that's good. It means that I can have epsilon be quite large and it still works. Yeah, these are the conditions for, you know, that we're going to want for the perturbation theory to work. We want that condition that allows epsilon to be quite large if the gap is big and still have these isomorphic subspaces of which we can define this direct rotation. Maybe I'm missing your point. Come and ask me after.
It's strange because, I mean, usually we ask this parameter to be very small.
Yeah, I'm bounding it. Okay, this is the maximum value. It has to be less than that.
Yes, but you are not saying, for example, that this is much less than 1, for example, that we usually consider.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you can see how I could take the norm of, you know, there's a trade-off, you know, to anything that I want to put in the norm of V compared to, you know, I can take out a term out of V and call that part of epsilon. So there's no scale of epsilon being like something where 1 is a particular scale, like large. We're gonna have to watch for that when we do Taylor expansions, that what we're doing Taylor expansions around is in fact a small parameter, but not yet. Yeah, come and ask me after. So we're gonna wrap it up for today, and we'll come back to this tomorrow. We're going to now we've got these two subspaces. Now we're going to find a systematic way to construct this unitary map. It goes from one to the other. Okay, I'll see you then.